On this Martin Luther King weekend, we've often looked back at the story of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and we've celebrated how the events of that time changed the story of racism in America for the better, that things were fixed, and that the work of dismantling racism in America was done. But we know this was never true. Racism still exists today. And we know that the institutions of our society, the media, the education system, the criminal justice system are designed to benefit white people and support the idea that white is normal, better, smarter, in contrast to black and other people of communities of color. And we may not even see it because it's the water that we are swimming in.
One slide back.
There you go.
The longer you swim in a culture, the more invisible it becomes. This morning, we're going to look back at one particular event in the past when Unitarian Universalist history intersected with the civil rights movement, and a time where white people told a lot of lies. We'll ask ourselves what lies we still might be telling ourselves today and how we might begin to build a vision for beloved community that doesn't include these untruths.
The story begins with this man. His name was Jimmie Lee Jackson. He was an African-American veteran and civil rights activist who lived in Marion, Alabama. In February of 1965, he was participating in a peaceful voting rights march demanding that all people, no matter their race, could vote. He was beaten and fatally shot by an Alabama state trooper, and he died 8 days later in the hospital. His death helped to inspire the civil rights activists to organize more voting rights marches, including the march from Selma to Montgomery in March of 1965.
That march to Montgomery became known as Bloody Sunday because as the march set off, state troopers and the county sheriff responded with violence, attacking the protesters as they walked over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Lots of reporters were there at the march with cameras, and the pictures and news coverage was broadcast all across the world, raising widespread support for the voting rights campaign. More marches were organized, and those marches and the work of the civil rights movement helped pass the Voting Rights Act in 1965.
After Bloody Sunday, Martin Luther King made a plea to clergy of conscience, that means ministers and rabbis and imams from all across America, to come to Selma and to join in those marches. Two of our former Foothills ministers, the Reverend Robert Bowman and the Reverend Walter Royal Jones, went to those marches. Another minister who went to those marches was named James Reeb. His friends called him Jim. He'd grown up north of here in Casper, Wyoming. He was working in Boston. Unfortunately, things didn't go so well for Jim Reeb and his friends after that march.
Jim, along with two other white Unitarian ministers, had walked to a nearby integrated black-owned restaurant where they ate dinner. Civil rights workers from out of town weren't welcome in Selma's white-owned restaurants, and they probably didn't want to eat there anyways. So let's see if we can find out what happened to James Reeb that night after they left dinner and walked outside. And I think we're going to need a detective or a reporter to help us get some more information. So I'm wondering if we have someone that might be able to help. Oh, there you are. Lenny, would you be able to help us out a little bit? So Lenny is going to be a little bit of a detective, a little bit of a reporter to help us figure out what happened after Jim and the other white ministers left the restaurant. And the words you're about to hear are the words of people who were directly there, who've just taken and quoted them.
We're speaking with the Reverend Mr. Clark B. Olson. And though it may be bitter memories for you, we would like to have you give us an account of what happened. Please, tell us what happened when you left the restaurant in Selma on Tuesday night.
Well, we turned to the right coming out of the restaurant and went down toward the intersection. We saw a group of four or five men, and they yelled at us, but we just sort of quickened our pace. We didn't run, but we continued walking in the same direction. Well, Jim Reeb was on the sidewalk nearest the street and slightly behind us as we were walking. He didn't look around, as I remember it, but I did look around just in time to see one man with some kind of a stick or a pipe or a club swing the stick violently at Jim. He swung the stick, and it hit him in the side of the head, and Jim Reeb immediately fell to the pavement on his back.
So Jim was rushed to a nearby black medical clinic because civil rights workers were not welcomed anywhere else. One of the city's two black doctors examined him and took an x-ray of his head. Jim was unconscious, and the doctor decided that he needed to be seen by a neurosurgeon. The closest one was at University Hospital in Birmingham, nearly 2 hours away. He was rushed there by ambulance.
Here's Dr. James Argiers, who treated Jim Reeb when he arrived at the hospital. Dr. Argiers.
It was obvious that he was comatose, and there was hardly any response to anything. So I just rushed him right away, right up to the operating room, and removed a large epidural hematoma and placed him on a respirator. And I had bad feelings that he wasn't going to survive. He lingered for 2 days and died on Thursday at 6:55 p.m.
Jim was attacked, treated, but died. So the day after the attack, the Selma Police Department held a press conference.
Okay, folks, we are about to hear from Wilson Baker, the sheriff of Selma, Alabama.
We have in custody now three men charged with assault with intent to murder. At the present time, we are holding them in custody. Gentlemen and ladies, I cannot go into any details about this case.
Eyewitnesses had identified the suspects within hours of the attack. Two of the three defendants were already known to the FBI because they had previous arrest records for fighting, and they disrupted other civil rights marches.
So even though eyewitnesses had identified them directly, no one was held accountable for this murder. So what happened? Why was there never any justice in this case?
A week later, a local businessman wrote a letter to the editor in the paper imploring every white citizen to contribute to a legal defense fund for the men arrested. His name was Saul Tepper, and he was one of the loudest segregationists in town.
What do you mean by segregationist, Saul?
A segregationist is a person who believed that white and black people should be separated and never, ever come together and interact with each other.
Mr. Tepper, can you share the contents of your letter with us now?
It is the duty of every white citizen to see that those white citizens who have been accused have legal help. Selma is fighting almost alone, but Selma is not fighting for itself alone. It is fighting for everything that stands for decency and Western civilization.
And things went downhill from there. Witnesses disappeared or refused to testify. No one would name names.
This is Frances Bowden. She worked on the street and saw the whole thing. She has only recently agreed to talk about it. What happened, Frances? Where were you at the time of the attack?
I think I was in my office at the pawn shop across the street. They asked me if I saw what happened. I told them I saw some people beating a man, but I didn't know who they were, and I stuck to that because we knew who it was. We just didn't admit we knew.
So all these people knew who it was, who had done it. They just wouldn't say anything?
Oh, yes, honey. Everybody knew who it was, but nobody would say a thing.
Well, it's kind of amazing that people were able to keep it under wraps.
Well, they covered it up, is what they done.
The defense attorney came up with an alternative conspiracy theory. His defense strategy was to argue that the civil rights movement was in need of a white martyr.
What do you mean by martyr?
A martyr is someone who dies for a cause. The civil rights movement already had many, many black martyrs, people like Jimmie Lee Jackson, but because of racism, not many white people took notice. The attorney's story was that the civil rights movement wanted a white martyr to get white people to care about civil rights, and they decided that the attack on Jim Reeb was the perfect opportunity. So they were the ones who conspired to kill him.
I am speaking to Mr. Joe Pilcher, attorney for the defense. What was your theory for the defense of the three men who attacked Reverend James Reed?
I submit to you, gentlemen, that under the law of this state, and without regard to whether these men had committed this attack or whether they didn't, under the law of the state, gentlemen, if this death resulted from malpractice, this gross, intentional, deliberate death caused by inattention and improper medical treatment, then, gentlemen, these defendants could not, under the law, be convicted of murder.
It was their theory that it was the civil rights movement that didn't provide the medical care that led to his death. It took the all-white male jury only 97 minutes to find the defendants not guilty. The FBI reopened the case in 2008, but they too abandoned it, saying there was no need to prosecute it. And to this day, no one has ever been held accountable for this murder.
Thousands of Black Americans were threatened, beaten and killed during the struggle for civil rights, and they never received equal justice under the law. The culture and institutions valued white people over Black people. James Reeb's story received a lot of attention at the time, but is James Reeb's story more important because he was white? Have things changed for the better? Do we still value white people more than people of color? Can everyone expect equal justice? Or is that all just another white lie?
So here's a question for you. What is a lie? Can someone help me out with that? What is a lie? Any thoughts up here?
What do we? Not number one.
What?
Not number one.
It's not number one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the definition? What do we think?
Misrepresentation.
Misrepresentation of the truth?
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts, yeah. So how about a white lie? What's a white lie? Anybody know? What do we think of when we say a white lie?
A lie that's made for a good reason.
Oh.
A lie that's maybe made for a good reason. Any other parts? Unconsequential, didn't really matter.
Yeah, consequential. A white lie could be a small lie that we might tell to protect someone's feelings. It's so small that we think that it's harmless or trivial.
But there's another definition of white lie. Last year, an NPR podcast rekindled interest in the unsolved murder of James Reeb. The two reporters picked up the case. They heard from witnesses who were too afraid to speak out back in the 60s. And they called their podcast White Lies. White not as in harmless, but white as in white people. Because what prevented justice from happening for James Reeb and for people of color then and now in this country are the lies, the untruths that white people, people like me, tell and believe about race and racism. It's the lies are the water that we swim in. They're lies we don't even notice. We may not even think they are lies, but they're lives that endanger the lives of people of color in our world.
Which is why on this MLK Sunday, we're talking about lies and that white culture tells about race, the lies that white culture tells about race, because we can't build a future without racism, without telling the truth. We must tell the truth about how we feel and think, what we were taught, what we've experienced, even if it's uncomfortable to say, even if it makes other people uncomfortable to hear. White people need to see that the water we swim in and to stop the white lies, but it's hard work. But together, we can do it.
In 1967, Dr. King wrote the book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? He was reflecting on where the civil rights movement had been and where it was going after the passing of the Voting Rights Act. And he said this to his white readers. Over the last few years, many Negroes, which is the word that Martin Luther King used to talk about African Americans or Black people, many Negroes have felt that their most troublesome adversary was not the obvious bigot of the Ku Klux Klan or the John Birch Society, but the white liberal who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers tranquility to equality. The white liberal must see that the Negro needs not only love, but justice. It is not enough to say we love Negroes, that we have many Negro friends. They must demand justice. But love that does not satisfy justice is no love at all. It is not conditional upon one staying in his place or watering down his demands in order to be considered respectable. In other words, white people, people who hold much of the power in our world, need to get uncomfortable, to truly listen to people of color, people impacted by racism in our society, and then change the system to make things right.
So in this congregation, we have people of all races and people with all different comforts and experiences around speaking about race and racism. To see where we are in the room, we're going to invite you in a time to reflect on a question. And the question is, when talking about race and racism, I feel...
We're going to invite you to think about that for a moment. And then if you have a phone that can connect to the internet, you can go to menti.com and enter these numbers, 69, 93, and 36. And when you do that, you can type your response. And when you hit submit, it will anonymously come up onto the screen. And so we'll get to see what people in the room, how they answer that question. Parents, people without smartphones, you might help those around you that might not have a phone. You can submit multiple times. This will help us get a kind of sense of ambiently in the room. How do we feel when we talk about race and racism?
So again, the question, when talking about race and racism, I feel, and your response, text your response.
Gonna go do a little tech.
Perhaps we're having a connectivity problem. There we go. I feel so uncomfortable, I don't know what to say. I'm afraid I might get it wrong.
Apparently the other ones aren't coming up, so I'm going to read some of the ones that you wrote. Angry, passionate, inadequate, nervous, discouraged, guilty, sad. Guilty for being the race that I was born into. I don't feel educated to have a powerful conversation. Some guilt, some hope. Some sadness, uncomfortable, I'm too little, privileged, ashamed. Like I have a lot to learn, powerless, justifiably uncomfortable, I want to be part of ternary community and society towards the long arc of justice, unqualified, more aware of my privilege, challenged, ashamed, angry, my children are half Latinx, we have experienced it. I am angry and guilty as a white person. I'm angry, I'm hopeless. I'm guilty for my ancestors. I'm passionate about erasing the gap. Hopeful I can identify something to change, that I'm at a standstill, that progress is not being made fast enough. Thank you.
It's difficult for those of us who are white because we've grown up in a culture where we didn't ever have to talk about race or think about our own race or code switch at school or work. We've been sheltered from the impacts of racism, both in the day-to-day and from racism in systems and institutions.
For people of color, talking about race and racism with white people can be difficult and painful. As Black journalist Renee Edo Lodge wrote in her 2014 blog post, I can no longer engage with the gulf of emotional disconnect that white people display when a person of color articulates their experience. You can see their eyes shut down and harden. It's like treacle is poured in their ears, blocking up their ear canals. It's like they can no longer hear us. But we need to talk about race and racism if we are to build that future. So I've lived in Fort Collins 3.5 years, and there's a phrase that I have heard over and over again. I wonder if you've heard it. It goes something like, Fort Collins is so white, we don't really have people of color here. Have you heard that before?
Maybe you have heard that. And let's do a little exercise. Again, let's go to menti.com and go to the next slide and take a guess as to the percentage of white people and the percentage of people of color in Fort Collins. Each point equals 1%. We're gonna hope this works. It worked at 8:30.
Why don't we just take a few hands? What do we think the percentage is? 82% white? Okay, what else? Other guesses? 5% people of color is your guess? 12% people of color? 25%? 20? Pardon? 90% white. So we're actually gonna invite some folks up to come help us give us an answer. So we need 10 volunteers to come up to the front.
Stand right up here.
And to stand right up here. All you need to do is hold something. So yep, just come on up.
Come on, Sylvia. Right up here.
And actually, if you all could stand to the one more up, stand right on the stage so
all
everyone
the way
can
up
see
on the
you.
Stage. There we go. You guys can stand up on the stage.
These are going to represent the percent of the population of Fort Collins. So hold up your signs. So the percentage of people in Fort Collins in the latest study data that we have that identify as a person of color, inclusive of people who identify Hispanic, is 20%. So 20, can you hold up your sign really, really high?
Really high.
20%. Oh, 30, not yet.
20.
20%. What do you think the percentage of incoming students at CSU are that identify as people of color? 40? The answer is 30%.
Oh, hold yourself high.
30% of incoming CSU students identify as people of color. All right, let's flip that a little bit. If you are over the age of 55, what percentage of the population do you think are white? You're over 55 in Fort Collins. 90%+, so we'll have 90% and 100 you can hold up. But let's say you're 30 years old, what do you think the percentage is? It's 80%. If you're an elementary school student, what do you think it is? It's 67%, so right in the middle between 60 and 70. Thank you very much for being our living percentages.
So when we say that Fort Collins is so white, we're essentially saying that the 30,000 plus people of color here don't count. It renders their presence and their contributions to our community not worthy of being counted or noticed. It feeds into a second white lie that Fort Collins is so progressive that racism isn't a problem here. Racism is a problem here. When we listen to people of color who live in here in Fort Collins, their stories, often painful, are filled with racism.
And so we have a challenge for you. We invite you to take a pledge to challenge others who insist on saying, Fort Collins is so white. We don't really have people of color here. Racism really isn't an issue here. I invite you to think about what you might say in response.
It's not an easy thing to do, figuring out what to say. So we're going to give you an opportunity to brainstorm with your neighbors and practice what you might say. So I want you to turn to the people around you and come up with a few responses that you might say when people say, Fort Collins is so white. There are no people of color here.
Now, disrupting these moments is not easy to do. It's awkward, especially when the people we're talking to, we might care about. We worry about if they're going to be upset if we challenge them and say, well, actually, I mean, I hear this all the time, but it's not true. Did you know that there's 30,000 people of color here in Fort Collins? That seems like a lot of people. That seems like we shouldn't say that they aren't here. It can be awkward to challenge our friends and other people, and yet it is so important to dismantle these stories, these lies that keep us from addressing the problems. There's actually a movement right now in our faith to add an eighth principle. So we have the seven principles already, and there's a movement to say we should add another one, one that says, and we'll pull it up in a minute, that we, members of UU congregations, covenant to journey towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. It's a movement that we're going to be voting on in an upcoming General Assembly. It would add this as a principle that would say that as part of our spiritual work as Unitarian Universalists, we need to do the work inside our hearts, inside our churches, inside our communities to dismantle racism. It actually mirrors one of the statements that came out of our visioning process last year about our congregation's vision.
Our newly launched Racial Justice and Healing Ministry team here at Foothills has made bookmarks for everyone. You're going to receive a bookmark on your way out of the service today, and they contain this eighth principle on one side and that vision statement on the other side. So this new group is hosting a monthly wake-up coffee and conversations on race gathering the second Saturday of every month from 8:30 to 10 a.m. at Dawsbach Coffee Shop North. It's a place to feel safe, discussing questions about racial justice, to get support, and keep having the conversation.
It is the work of all of us to be undoing racism in our society, but we can't do it alone. I'm glad we have partners like the Racial Justice and Healing Team and each other so we can stumble through this work together. Are you ready to give it a shot? Amen.